And welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, your host for the program, and really glad to be back joining the program after a little hiatus. We have a lot of things going on. Certainly, you can always find out more information by going to the Natural Nurse's website, which is www.naturalnurse.com for our series of lectures, walks, talks, trips, eco tours, and so much more, staying at the cutting edge of natural medicine. But for today's program, we have an excellent speaker and physician and colleague of mine who I really always enjoy discussing natural health care, and he's the author of a book, How Come They're Happy and I'm Not? The Complete Natural Program for Healing Depression for Good. And his name is Dr. Peter Bongiorno. He's a naturopathic doctor and a licensed acupuncturist. He has two clinics in New York City called Inner Source Natural Health and Acupuncture. And he was a pre-doctoral fellow of the National Institutes of Health and did quite a bit of work at Yale. And then he trained at Bastyr University, one of the foremost colleges and universities of natural health care. He teaches integrative medicine electives at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and also at the Natural Gourmet Institute in New York. He blogs, and he's been on national TV. He kind of reminds me of a younger version of myself there, doing all these kinds of interesting, wonderful things there. And he's also president of the New York Association of Naturopathic Physicians, and chosen Naturopathic Physician of the Year in New York State in 2008. Now, he's also written and contributed to a fabulous textbook of evidence-based natural medicine called The Textbook of Natural Medicine. And he wrote more of a doctor-oriented book on depression, Healing Depression, Integrated Naturopathic Conventional Therapies for Depression. But we're going to be speaking more about his book here, which is, I think it would be found on Amazon. I'm not sure who the publisher was. Maybe he can tell us. And talk about how come they're happy and I'm not. Dr. Bongiorno, are you there?
Yes, Dr.
Hey.
Z. So great to hear your voice.
Yes, you too. So it's great that you're still in the trenches and working hard for the profession of naturopathic medicine. You know, before we get into depression, we're assuming that our listeners know what a naturopathic doctor is. Sometimes we, assume those types of things, us colleagues chatting with each other, but it's actually not a great assumption, as many people have no idea what it is. So why don't you elucidate us what your training was, which we kind of talked about a little bit, what a naturopathic doctor is, and we'll forward then into the program.
Sure. Well, there's three kinds of physicians. There's medical doctors, MDs, which most people know about, osteopathic physicians, and then naturopathic physicians. And the trainings have similarities and differences. The similarities is that pretty much all three go to four-year medical programs and learn medicine at the same level, learn our anatomy and our physiology and how to do blood draws and minor surgery and physical exam and all the basics that you'd expect from a regular doc that you would go see. So beyond that, medical doctors really, they kind of learned that the body works in systems. So if you have a problem with your skin, you see a dermatologist. You have a problem with your stomach, you see a gastroenterologist. Osteopathic doctors have a similar view. They have a little bit more training in musculoskeletal work, similar to what a chiropractor does, and the belief is that when the musculoskeletal system is open and working well, then the nerve to the organs work and the body's physiology works better. Today's osteopathic physician, many of them actually just really practice very similar to conventional medical doctors. There are some that hold that more holistic musculoskeletal philosophy, but many, I think, are very similar to a regular medical doctor. And the naturopathic doctors, we learn really that the body is kind of a whole. It's a much more holistic view, and we get a lot of more advanced training in things like diet, exercise, counseling work, herbal medications, vitamin therapies. And the idea is that you know, the body is one unit, and that you really want to figure out what the underlying cause of a person's condition is, and treat that as opposed to just treating symptoms. So if there is an issue with the skin, for example, a conventional doctor, like we said, would go see a dermatologist. But when we think about it from a naturopathic perspective, when there's a problem with the skin, a lot of times naturopaths will say, well, we really got to work on your digestion, you know, because that's where it starts, as an example. So that's really the difference. Naturopaths are trained to be excellent primary care physicians, and in the States we're licensed. We do practice as primary care physicians and can do all the things. Unfortunately, the state of New York is not one of those states, which is where I practice. And so there's a lot of things that we really can't do yet here, but we are working very hard on getting licensing. And if anyone out there from New York is interested, we can give information about how to call your legislator and how to, you know, just speak to the powers that be and tell them that, look, we want this medicine license. You know, Connecticut's been licensed since 1922, and New Yorkers, unfortunately, aren't allowed to go see a licensed naturopathic doctor yet.
Yeah, that's a weird thing. I mean, okay, that's great. Thank you so much for that encapsulation of naturopathic medicine. Now let's talk a little bit about your book. A lot of people have depression, and sometimes it's mild and sometimes it's debilitating. So many people suffer from these things and are on prescription drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if they're, like, I haven't seen, me personally, a prescription approach really be the total solution for people's depression there. So in your book, you talk a lot about that depression and low moods have roots in all of these other holistic type of things that you were talking about, all these other organ system relationships, which is very different from conventional docs who bought into the whole neurotransmitter molecule. You know, you're depressed because you either have low dopamine or serotonin. Here's the medicine which, you know, allows these neurotransmitters, for those who don't know what that is, these chemicals which allow you to think in certain ways and behave in certain ways. But it's not looking at any of these other things. It also doesn't even look at the quantum level of healing, which I know counseling and energetic medicine and homeopathy and acupuncture look at the idea that the thought the thought is before the actual biochemistry, the quantum event there. So why don't you talk a little bit about how you got interested in depression and how your approach is very unique?
Sure. Well, it's interesting. Before I even got involved in natural medicine, I grew up in Staten Island. We went to conventional doctors. There wasn't really a lot of natural medicine in the house, although my mom, wasn't a fan of medications. We used them regularly because that's what, doctors said to do, right? And I was interested in medicine, and I was doing research. Actually, I was doing a pre-doctoral fellowship at the NIH, and I was thinking about, I'm going to apply to medical school. And the research was actually in, we did a lot of studying of the stress system. There was a fellow named Philip Gold there, who who's Giulio Licinio, another medical doctor. These people were, really interested in what's called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, and they were very well known for their studies in that. So, and this was at the National Institute of Mental Health and down in Bethesda, Maryland. And so I was there, and I learned a lot from them about how to study the stress system. And we did a lot of studies on depression, on how depression medications work. We did a lot of anxiety and depression studies on animals. And we learned a lot about how the brain really functions. We learned a lot about the relationship with inflammation and stress and depression. There's a middle part of the brain called the hypothalamus, and it's basically where the immune system, the nervous system, and the hormonal system all meet and talk to each other. And what we learned there is that stress from the outside of the brain will send signals in there and really change our physiology and really change how inflammation works, how our hormones work, and how the nervous system works, and is a huge player in things like depression and things like anxiety. So that's what I started learning there. I had no interest in natural medicine. And then through some personal experiences and a friend who was sick, I learned about naturopathic medicine and saw the value of it, so I made a decision to go to naturopathic medical school instead of conventional medical school. And then when I got out to practice, I started my practice in New York, and one of the things I noticed is that everybody pretty much was taking some kind of antidepressant. And even if people came in for back pain or came in for digestive issues and things, I noticed most of my patients were on Lexapro, Zoloft, Prozac at the time, and a few others like that. And it was very, very common. So I started gathering a lot of information about how to interact with these medications and learning even more about them than we did in school. And that's where this kind of all started for me, because I realized there wasn't really any good resources that was putting all this physiology together. And one of the things I learned is that, there's an old joke, and the joke is that a man walks out of a bar and he's drunk, and he realizes he lost his keys in the parking lot. Okay, so it's a very dark parking lot. His car is parked in one dark corner, and there's only one light post that's lit in the other corner. So he's looking for his keys under the light post, and a cop comes up to him and says, "Man, you know, what are you doing? I'm looking for my keys." He says, "Well, how do you know they're here? There's a whole parking lot to look at." And the fellow says, "Well, I don't know, but the light's better here." You know. So and it's very analogous to what's going on with, I think, psychiatry and what we're doing with the medications. In my opinion, neurotransmitters, you know, those feel-good molecules in the brain that we need for balanced emotion aren't the largest percentage of why we have mood issues. In fact, it's interesting because when you look at the meta-analyses, meaning the large studies of antidepressants, kind of looking at them as a whole, what we've learned is really they only work about 27 to 30-something percent of the time, around the amount that placebo works. And in my opinion, that suggests to us that maybe that's how much neurotransmitters alone are really part of the process. And I think there's another 70% that are many, many other things, and that things like depression and mood disorders in general are really just the tip of the iceberg. It's just telling us something's wrong and that something's out of balance with the body. And when we look at it that way and start looking at the body's physiology and looking at other reasons why people have mood disorders, what we find is that no one person is alike, and that it's usually a combination of factors. It's things like sleep, it's hormonal dysregulation, maybe women's reproductive hormones or thyroid or low testosterone, and it can be digestive issues, and it can be nutrient deficiencies, and that all these things together, you know, will in its totality become, you know, low mood.
Yeah, and I know it's funny because I was listening to a lecture by well-known herbalist David Winston, and he was looking at talking about depression and how the Cherokee Native American medicine people look at it. It's very interesting how they look at that. There's a gut depression,
right,
and a liver depression, and a I guess a hormonal and menstrual depression, and then an old man's grumpy depression, and then seasonal affective disorder. And they're all very different and treated very different. It's like you treat the person that has the problem, not actually the depression itself.
Right, exactly. You know, and it's interesting because in Chinese medicine, there's meridians throughout the body that represent different organs. In Chinese medicine, the brain isn't even considered an organ. You know, it's sort of considered just this bundle of nerves that it responds to what's going on in the rest of the body.
Fascinating,
And in modern medicine, really, we look at the brain as the end-all, be-all with mood disorders. And I think a more holistic view is to say, well, you know, the brain is a piece of it, but really the rest of the body very, very much affects what's going on in the brain and how we feel and how our mood is.
What about other things, Dr. Bujorna, like spiritual crisis, life mm-hmm. events, things like that, day-to-day stress, and also yeah. just repetition and maybe learning poor, like learned behavior. I mean, mm-hmm. I can't blame all depression on that. But again, it's one of those many
yeah.
categories that
yeah.
we talked about.
It's a very strong piece. In fact, when I was at the National Institutes of Health and we did research, the animal model for depression was stressing out an animal to the point where it didn't feel it had control over its life. So you're subjected to a random series of events. And I'm not talking about necessarily like torture and things that hurt physically. I'm just talking about things like, you know, it doesn't know, you know, if it's going to get moved from one cage to another, and where it's going to be at night, and the light is on at night too long, and all these different things, and it gets put in cages with different rats it didn't meet before. And if you do that to an animal long enough, or you leave it alone too long, or after a while, it starts to give up, and it gets depressed.
Mm.
And really, in a sense, the animal model for depression is very similar to, I think, what's going on with a lot of human beings. You know, when I work with my patients, you know, yesterday I had a woman who came in, and she's very, very stressed out because work is so unbelievably stressful for her, the relationships with her superiors, with her bosses, with her co-managers, you know, all these things that are just kind of, they feel like they're caving in on her, that she doesn't, you know, she can't spend the time doing things she would like to do for herself because she has to do these things and she doesn't know what's coming next. And really, there's no difference between that person, and that's, I think, the experience of many people, and the animal model of depression is very similar. It's a randomized, you know, unscheduled events that you feel you don't have control over to the point where you feel overwhelmed.
Huh. There's a lot of resources. I know you have a link, book links about positivity and things like that, about mm-hmm. how people can unlearn some of these negative behavioral patterns and ways of thinking that they have. Because I think that the idea is if you thought it long enough, you hardwire it into your nervous system because there's a lot of plasticity in the nerves. Is that true?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the nervous system is a beautiful thing. It's very changeable. It can grow. It could learn new things. It could create new patterns. And from a mood standpoint, if you're talking about psychology, it's very important. You know, when I work with patients, I usually tell them the first step is realizing what the thoughts are. You know, whether it's anxiety or even depression, sometimes we get to a place where the thoughts become so, it becomes our default mechanism, thinking a certain way, and we don't even realize we're doing it anymore. You know, they say with alcoholism, the first step is knowing that you're drinking, right? Because yeah. if you don't even realize it, if you're just kind of unconsciously going to the bar and pouring yourself a drink and two or three go down before you even realize you're doing it, it's very hard to fix that pattern. And it's the same thing with thinking. You know, a lot of times we'll put a lot of energy in our thought into things that maybe aren't good for us or healthy for us. So the first step is to realize we're doing that. And then the second step is to create a plan to recognize those regularly and change them.
So isn't thinking a conversation that we're having to ourselves? Like a lot of times we don't think out loud, like I
right.
can't broadcast my thoughts over the radio here, but it almost is. It's almost like you're having
yeah.
It's almost like someone else is talking to you at yeah. the same time when you're having some of these thoughts, right?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I had a 16-year-old girl who came in with her mom, and, you know, we were working on depression. This was probably a couple of weeks ago. And we were talking about thoughts, and I told her, I said, it's almost like a cassette tape, you know, playing a certain message over and over in your head. And she looked at me, and she looked at her mom, and she says, cassette tape? What's that?
A cassette tape? You're dating yourself there, doctor.
Right. Right. I know you said the younger version of you, and I was thinking to myself, I'm not sure he knows how old.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
But the point is exactly what you're saying. It's like there's this, MP3 player or something that's in our head and is constantly repeating certain messages. And you know, it's like if you wake up and you say to yourself, this is a bad day, then subconsciously, then that sets the tone for the day, So that's important. Now, look, many people, and you know, I know they're listening and they're saying, well, look, you know, if I could think that way, I wouldn't be depressed.
Correct.
You know, so it's, so there's more involved than just that, and not everyone, depression isn't simply, changing your thoughts and everybody can do it. It's, there's many people, there's a lot more involved, and you have to really work on the other things along with it, the physiology, the hormonal balance, sometimes the neurotransmitters. And so I guess, we're talking about thoughts, but it's really all of those things together that kind of need to be worked on at the same time to really create a change.
You know, one thing that's interesting is people's blood sugar. I think we have a pandemic of blood sugar problems. And I find in my own self personally that if my blood sugar goes down, which I try not to do because I figured this out after, well more than half a century of thinking about these things. But, it's like I find that if my blood sugar goes down, I start to act a little bit cagey and snappy. And so I've been, researching that about myself and figuring that out. I find that that's one of those patterns for depression as well.
Yeah, well, when blood sugar drops or is just very dysregulated, that sends us a stress signal, that gets put out throughout the body. And so that absolutely will play a role in somebody's mood. You know, when I work with people and they first come in, the first three things I look at that I like to think about or even work on first is making sure people are sleeping well, because when people aren't sleeping well, it's very, very hard to have a balanced mood. When people aren't pooping well and their digestion isn't good, most of the neurotransmitters are made in your digestive tract. So when I hear digestion isn't good or has a long history of not doing well, that's absolutely something we need to work on. And the third thing is blood sugar. When blood sugar is up and down, it's very hard to create a nice, balanced, happy mood. You're definitely hitting on one of the three pillars there so important to start with.
So now the blood sugar, that's pretty complex. Go through a little bit about what's happening to somebody if their blood sugar is off and how that's tied into emotions eventually.
Yeah, well, blood sugar is a very powerful signal in the body, because we're all animals. And as animals, when blood sugar drops, it sends the signal to the primitive part of the brain that, we need more food. We're going to starve here. And so that primitive brain will also access that middle part of the brain we talked about earlier and create a powerful stress response. And if people are predisposed to depression, for a lot of people, that'll put them into a very low mood, and it will contribute to that mood. So it's very much a built-in kind of primitive cycle. And some people will end up, going and looking for food. Unfortunately, when blood sugar gets low, what happens is a lot of times we'll look for sugar because that's the quick fix, right? And it makes the brain temporarily happy. But the problem is when you eat the quick sugar, it actually ends up kind of bouncing your blood sugar around even further, and that'll contribute to even more long term. So what I usually tell people is that when we're working on blood sugar, I think it's very important to eat a really good solid breakfast with protein. It's certainly been shown that when you eat good protein earlier in the day, it keeps your blood sugar and your insulin levels, which is the hormone that helps, regulate your blood sugar in a much better place and in a much kind of more consistent place throughout the day. So eating plenty of protein in the morning, some good healthy fat, and maybe a good healthy carbohydrate to go with that.
I was going to say, what about the fiber connection, because that slowly releases the nutrients through the gut so that it's not all absorbed all at once.
Absolutely, yeah. So good, healthy fiber is definitely essential. And the good thing about the fiber is that it also keeps your digestive system working better and keeps the flora healthy and will keep the inflammation down. And inflammation, there's a lot of research, some of which, you know, we did when I was doing research, showed that, you know, there's a very strong correlation between inflammation in the body and in the brain and these mood disorders.
Huh.
So the fiber is even good to handle, you know, for that aspect as well. So,
now, how would someone know that they're inflamed?
Well, there's a couple of ways. You know, some people, it just shows up on their skin, and you just know they get a lot of things like rashes and redness, or you'll see that redness on their face after they eat. So that's one way to tell. Or they have actual, you know, inflammatory conditions like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease or arthritis or even autoimmune conditions. So that's another way. And then the third way is sometimes I also have people run certain blood tests. There's a blood test called C-reactive protein, which talks about inflammation. There's another blood test called ESR, erythrocyte sedimentation rate, which gives you a general idea of inflammation. And there's another one called interleukin-6, which a lot of doctors really don't look at. But it's also another way to find out more about inflammation in the body, and I think has a strong correlation with things like depression and mood disorders as well. You know, there's no perfect blood tests, but they can give us a clue along with what's going on with the symptoms the patient has.
Now, oftentimes when people are inflamed, naturopathic doctors will use things like turmeric and fish oil and change the, like maybe they're eating too much meat that's not healthy meat. What are some of the interventions that you might do if you found that somebody was inflamed?
Right. Yeah, well, the first step is to work with the diet and see if there are any things that are inflammatory. So if they have a more pro-inflammatory diet, especially if it's a lot of meats that aren't grass-fed and, you know, or grain-fed, that'll contribute more to inflammation. For some people, dairy products can be very inflammatory. For some people, corn can be. You know, everyone's a little different, and it's hard to create a broad, you know, category saying what's inflammatory and what isn't. Certainly, if they're not eating good quality food, you know, if they're eating a lot of processed food and food with, you know, chemicals and preservatives and things, that's certainly something to work on. You know, lowering the sugar content, getting rid of simple sugars is important. And then, you know, if I don't know somebody or if I need to just make a broad recommendation, probably one of the most proven anti-inflammatory diets around is the Mediterranean diet.
What's that?
Well, the Mediterranean diet comes from, you know, the areas like where my family comes from, right? My last name's Buongiorno. My family all comes from Sicily. And so the areas around Sicily and Italy and that whole Mediterranean coastal area, the foods that developed there were mostly plants, eating a lot of plants, eating some beans, eating raw nuts and seeds, fish, you know, maybe a little bit of meat here and there, and then very good quality whole grains. And it's been found that a diet like that, and also high in good healthy fats like olive oils as well. And it's been found that eating that way tends to very much lower inflammation in your body. And there's these wonderful studies out of Spain, actually, that showed how effective it is for both preventing and treating things like anxiety and depression.
So just changing the diet to a more Mediterranean-based diet makes a big difference in the mood based on the research and lowering inflammation. That's fascinating.
Yeah, and my guess is, you know, with that diet, people are getting more fiber, so it helps the things we talked about. They're getting really good quality nutrients, so that's supporting the whole system and the brain and the body, and they're lowering inflammation as well. So it's just, you know, and it's just very balancing. So like I said, I mean, everyone's different, and maybe one of those particular foods might not work for everyone, but overall, I think if I had to pick a diet, and especially if I didn't know someone, that's probably would be a great place to start.
Well, I'm looking at the time, and it's half past. So we're going to take a little break, identify the network, and maybe promo some shows, and we'll be back with Dr. Bongiorno talking about depression and his new book. So stay with us, folks. And we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zampro, naturopathic physician and herbalist, and also professor at the University of Bridgeport, where we train naturopathic physicians. And I helped start the school back in 1996. And the school is now the only school on the East Coast that trains naturopathic physicians, and we're really excited to continue in that legacy. We just graduated another class of naturopathic physicians to go out there and make their mark on the healthcare of tomorrow. And we have with us not a graduate of our program, but an illustrious graduate, Dr. Peter Bongiorno. He's a naturopathic physician and a licensed acupuncturist. And he's the author of How Come They're Happy and I'm Not. I love that title. Excellent. Complete Natural Program for Healing Depression for Good. So welcome back to the program. And
thank you. You know, I have to come clean. My wife actually came up with that title.
Well, you know what? My wife came up with my website title and a lot of good things. So sometimes you need a good partnership but that's good. I'm so glad you admitted that. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So we're discussing depression from a holistic model. Now, one of the interesting things is the old naturopathic. You know, I always like to, you know, we just graduated a new group, and some people say, well, what makes naturopaths different from, like, green allopaths, like Dr. Oz or whatever? And I always say, well, it's our philosophy. We always go back to these philosophical pillars that steer our medicine. Stimulate the healing power of nature, doctor as teacher, prevention, treat the underlying cause, and things like that. So one thing that's interesting that I found, Dr. Bongiorno, is that when people are on these medications, you mentioned some of them in the beginning of the broadcast, and I do some lab tests looking at their neurotransmitters and the very amino acids that make these neurotransmitters, I find that it never really improves the amount of neurotransmitters in their brain or in their body or in the lab test or whatnot. So after a while, these medicines stop working, I assume. Can you comment all on that and the whole concept of you are what you absorb and the whole protein, amino acid, neurotransmitter kind of conundrum?
Sure. You know, it's kind of interesting, but what's been shown is really with the medications, what tends to happen is it actually sort of depletes the very system you're trying to support. And, you know, because when somebody has a true neurotransmitter issue and the medication works, you know, I have to say one thing. Is if people are in the very, very deep throes of depression and it is mostly a neurotransmitter issue, which I know isn't a high percentage of the cases, but sometimes it is, and the medication works, it can be a blessing and really seem like a miracle to people. And that does happen. So we don't want to completely throw out conventional medicine all the time, because when used appropriately, it can be very helpful.
It has its place, like all...
Absolutely.
All parts of medicine, it's part of the paradigm, but not where to stop.
But the issue is even when it does work, which like we said is maybe, you know, about 30% of the time, it's still not fixing the underlying reason why those neurotransmitters got imbalanced to begin with. So we still need to go in and really think about, okay, what's going with a person's sleep, what's going on with their digestion, their absorption, the foods they're eating, inflammation, blood sugar, all the things we talked about. So we still have to get back to that at some point, because what ends up happening is over time, these things do stop working, usually within a year to 2 years. And then patients, unfortunately, start playing the game of roulette with the medications, where then they try another one, then they try another one. This one didn't work, and this one had side effects. And it really does become a guessing game, because no one really, you know, none of us really understand exactly how these things work. You know, and I don't pretend to know either, but one thing I do know is when you give the body all the things it really needs to help heal itself, it figures it out and it can fix things. And that's really, you know, from a naturopathic standpoint, I think that's what makes naturopathic medicine so exciting, is that, you know, we just give the body what the things it needs to heal, and we let the body do the work.
So your job is to figure out, like a medical detective. I always call myself like a monk, like a medical detective, trying to figure out what the body needs. That's a big part of our job.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and take away anything that we think is what, you know, what naturopaths call the obstacle to cure. So if there's anything obvious,
right,
that's an issue. You know, if somebody's getting, let's say they have a job where they're getting a strong toxicity every day of some kind of chemical, then obviously that might be worth, you know, trying to
get away from that. Well, I'll give you an example. Like, I sometimes start out my clinical forum class, which I teach the third years, with an interesting question. I say to the students, how does bad digestion eventually sometimes cause depression in people? And they look at me like, what? What's he talking about? Until they start thinking that model, because, you know, they're busy studying all their anatomy and physiology and biochemistry and pathology, but they're not thinking naturopathically first. So what I'm saying is that when I run these amino acid testings, I'm amazed. Like, here's a person that has depression. They come into my office, and they eat meat. They seem like they eat plenty of protein, yet when I check them, it's almost like they have kwashiorkor, that, you know, that disease where the kids have the big bellies and they're somewhere in a third world country, they're not getting enough protein. Or maybe that's marasmus, I forget. But anyway, nonetheless, I'm like, what is going on here? They're not absorbing things.
Mm-hmm.
So my job as an ND is to fix their gut.
Right.
I'm sure you do the same thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, because it's you could take in everything you need, but if the digestion isn't really absorbing, it's you know, you're not going to get what you need.
Now, some people I know do have some genetic polymorphisms of the enzymes that break down the neurotransmitters. Because, you know, maybe you could just go over how that happens. What happens with a thought, like, and a feeling with the neurotransmitters and the information jumping across the synapse?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, as we were talking about earlier, thoughts are definitely part of the start of many biochemical processes in the nervous system and in the body. And when you generate a thought, you're really generating it in the outer part of the brain, the cortex part. So that's the part that makes us humans human, right? Because we have this very developed system in the outer part of the brain called cortex. And those thoughts send signals into the middle part of the brain. You know, and that middle part of the brain is, like we talked about earlier, the hypothalamus, that area where the immune system, the nervous system, and the hormonal system all meet and talk to each other. And from there, it sends signals out into the body. And, for example, the adrenal glands get signals from there. And the adrenal glands, their job, they're these little glands that sit at the top of the kidneys. They're very, very small. And they're made to put out stress hormones from time to time. The interesting thing is that they're not really made to be working that often. And, you know, and I see a lot of patients who have scans for other things. And what we'll see is that a lot of patients who are very stressed, their adrenal glands are actually bigger than what's considered normal.
Wow.
And or they have cysts on them or things like that. And a lot of doctors will look at that and say, oh, well, you know, that's just artifactual and it doesn't really play a role in anything that we need to be concerned with. And when I look at that, it tells me, wow, you know, those adrenal glands are just getting so overworked.
Mm.
And that's telling me that you know, those thoughts are driving that physiology to create those changes in the body. And those adrenal glands, even though they're small, they make very powerful hormones and stress things. And then they make catecholamines, which are your stress hormones, and cortisol. And those things go out into the body and really change your physiology. They change how your vessels dilate. They change how you react to your environment. They change blood sugar regulation in the liver, all these different things. And so, you know, it's really important, as we were talking about, to look at all of those factors when you're working with someone with a mood issue and say, okay, well, how can we start bringing change in all those places?
Now, as the stress continues, it does impact the hormones. I know you have a nice section in your book on hormones and their huge role. And I'm not talking about the blood sugar hormones, which we've already covered.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the kind of like the male and female hormones, which
right.
are related to the adrenals.
Yeah. Well, for example, estrogen plays a very strong role in the brain in how serotonin is used or not used. Now, I know we're focusing a little bit on neurotransmitters, but unfortunately, that's where all the research is, right? So,
yeah.
So we're still going to end up spending a little more time talking about it than maybe you know should be. But yeah, but that's one example. So when women's hormones are off, now again, when a person's stressed out, if you're running from a bear, you're probably not going to be thinking about sexual activity, you know, because you're running from a bear, right? So what happens to that whole reproductive system and those reproductive hormones? They all get out of whack. Many of them get too low. And when that goes on chronically, then things like estrogen won't bathe the brain properly, which means serotonin won't be made, and the serotonin receptors won't be working to recognize that serotonin that's supposed to be made.
Mm.
So, and it's been shown that, you know, in many cases of what they call treatment-resistant depression, when hormonal levels are brought back into balance, a lot of times then people start to do better. And testosterone can be also one of those hormones, too. And it's true not just for men, but also for women.
Mm.
And I'm not talking about raising levels to, you know, very, very high, what we call supra-physiologic levels or dangerous levels. I'm just talking about making sure they're in somewhere in the normal range, you know, maybe even in the low normal range sometimes can be enough to help people feel better.
Absolutely. I've seen that, too. Now, are there any herbs that are very, you know, my love is, of course, botanical
yeah.
medicine
mm-hmm.
in teaching and whatnot. Are there any herbs that have really shown to be helpful for the treatment of depression?
Well, I mean, you know, and I'm sure many of your listeners know this already. I mean, St. John's wort is the most studied herb of all time and clearly has been shown to be very, very helpful. And interestingly, and you probably know better than I do, but my understanding is that it was often used as a digestive herb, something that was very helpful for digestion. In fact, I think David Winston talks about that, about it being very helpful for digestion. And so it's interesting that one of the best mood herbs and depression herbs is actually a great herb for digestion. Two other herbs that I actually spend a lot of time using when I'm working with depression is turmeric, which we had mentioned before, which has a beautiful anti-inflammatory activity, and actually saffron, which is the plant crocus, which also has some good studies about for depression and lifting low mood. And interestingly, turmeric and saffron are also really wonderful for digestive health. So again, I think it keeps bringing us back to that correlation between good digestion and good brain and mood.
Sometimes people have a lot of low energy with depression, and so putting a good herbal adaptogen sometimes
mm-hmm.
is a good idea in a balanced formula. Are there any of your favorite? I know at TCM they
yeah.
do quite a bit of ginseng and
mm-hmm.
Some reishi and things like that. Are there any ones that you find interesting?
Well, you know, and again, it depends on the person.
Right.
If we're looking for
okay.
something and there's a blood sugar component, I love the ginseng, the Panax ginseng can be okay. beautiful. If there's a very strong stress component, ashwagandha, which hails from the Ayurvedic, you know, medicine from India, I think is a wonderful herb as well. If we're just really trying to support the adrenal glands, Eleutherococcus is a beautiful herb. It's very gentle and very helpful as an adaptogen. I'll often use rhodiola when there's depression with anxiety.
You know, it's a nice one, mimosa.
Mimosa.
Yeah, you should look that up.
I will.
That's your homework.
Uh-huh.
Just giving homework to
I thought that was like a breakfast alcoholic beverage. No.
No, not that mimosa. That's
not
true,
that
yeah.
mimosa.
No, the mimosa, which is, you know, I grew up with a giant mimosa on my front lawn living in Long Island and never knew that it was one of the top Chinese herbs for depression. And when I started, it's called Hehuan Pi, Chinese name, Hehuan Pi. What it means, I'm not sure, but... it's the some of the research and even my own uses in my office here has been startling as far as... Now, of course, in TCM, like in many herbal traditions, they don't usually use one herb. So it's combined
right.
with different things. So, for instance, if I had a patient with seasonal affective disorder, I might use Hehuan Pi, rose petal, St. John's wort, and a little lemon balm to uplift the spirits, you know? If they had low energy, like you mentioned the great herbs for those types of things, if they were a grumpy old man that was, you really kind of knew that they were, the testosterone was low, I might use things that have been evidence-based to raise testosterone, like dopa bean, I find.
Right.
Well studied to raise testosterone, and this is the macuna, and it also seems to balance some of the chemistry in the brain.
Yeah, it's beautiful, and it's, you know, using them together is nice as well because they hit different aspects of the whole system. So
how do you combine? I know you do acupuncture, and that's always fascinating. Are there different points for depression? I know it depends on where the imbalance is, but like say someone came in and they had a lot of anger with depression.
Right.
Would you do different points than somebody who was just depressed and they didn't really have anger? Maybe they had fear and anxiety?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, again, like you're saying, there's different ways to look at depression in Chinese medicine. So someone with a lot of anger might have a lot of energy that's stuck. So you could probably, you know, I'd have to get more information, but it's probably a person with more excess. So you would do points that are kind of trying to release that excess energy and get it moving. Whereas other people with just very, very low energy and they seem really depleted, they might need points that actually, you know, pick up their energy and kind of nourish them and raise them up. So it's interesting because you could have the same, you know, end point of depression, but you would actually give them very different treatments. There's a very typical depression, what they call pathology in Chinese medicine, is excess phlegm. So we're, and again, it comes back to digestion. The digestion isn't working. We take in foods and things, and it kind of creates just this muck in our system that gets stuck. And you can actually see it often on the tongue. You look at the tongue, and you just see the stuck, you know, very heavy, thick coat, especially in the middle and in the back of the tongue.
Right.
So in those cases, we'll use points that kind of drain, what they call drain damp, and sort of move the phlegm. Because the Chinese would say that the phlegm mists the mind, you know, so the mind gets all cloudy and low because of all this stuckness going on in the digestive area.
Now, that's interesting because the mind in Western medicine is considered kind of in the brain. In holistic medicine, the mind has no location. It's almost like an electron. It's the probability. In Chinese medicine, the Han is in the heart. So that means that the heart has to be part of the depression at some level, because I know it's kind of related to if people have disturbed... I guess in Chinese medicine they look at depression as some disturbance in the spirit. I don't mean the spirit that survives death, but your kind of your consciousness, your dreams, and things like that.
Yeah, well, in Chinese medicine, the heart is where the spirit is, and that's where really the decisions are first felt and made, you know. In Chinese medicine, the heart gives it those decisions, and you make those decisions, and you have your plan that your spirit came up with, then you give it to the liver, And the liver is considered the general. So the liver actually carries out the plans. So sometimes even with depression, you have people who just never found what they wanted. They never really felt from their heart what they wanted to do, and that could be a driving force in why people have poor mood. But for other people, they really do know what their heart says, and they know what they want to do, but they just can't carry it out. Like, the motivation isn't there. And so even from a Chinese medicine standpoint, you know, you may want to work differently depending on whether it's a spirit issue or whether it's more of a liver motivation issue. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
and it's really fascinating because when you support those particular aspects of a person, then you just see them blossom, you know, and it just gets so much brighter because now you're really addressing where it's at.
So a lot of your work, it seems like, is balancing these myriad approaches that you see in a person, the minerals, their chemistry, the hormones.
There's so many amazing aspects to who we are, and it's really such an honor to just work with people and hear the stories and try to understand for them where are those factors that we want to work on. Like you mentioned Makuna before, which is, you know, the velvet bean, which has a little bit of extra dopamine in it. Now, sometimes when it's, in Chinese medicine, a liver motivation issue, you know, what's a beautiful neurotransmitter to raise motivation? Dopamine, you know.
Right.
So sometimes working in a Chinese aspect and even using the Western herbs to support that can be really helpful, too. So there's just so many mixes. You know, when patients come in, I don't have a protocol that, okay, you have depression here, this is what you do. It's really us sitting down with a blank piece of paper and figuring it out together, the patient and I, and coming up with what's going to work for them.
And that's very unique, and that's why it works, because you're really focusing on the uniqueness of that particular patient's presentation and what type of depression they have, or maybe they have multiple types. And sometimes, I guess the other thing is, sometimes it takes a little bit of time to unravel that mystery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, oftentimes it's not a one-visit thing. And, you know, and I think patients know that because most of the patients I work with, you know, they've been to a number of doctors and many have already tried many medications, and now they're finally realizing, you know what, I can't just take a pill and it goes away, that I really need to address a number of things. So they know that coming in, and I think that's why they look for naturopathic doctors.
And why they should get your book, How Come They're Happy and I'm
thank
Not.
You. So yeah, well, I think it's a great place to start.
Yeah.
You know, it's short. I tried to make it simple. In fact, the beginning of the book has very quick steps just to get started that I find can help people feel better no matter where they're coming from and what the individual factors are. And then once you move through that, then you can read the different chapters on the individual factors and figure out which ones make the most sense for you.
For you, right. So it's kind of like read like that, sort of, where you look and see which ones you seem to fit. I like that, and that's, you know, because some books are just, you know, you got to kind of plod through the whole thing in order.
Right.
And you
realize that it's... Yeah, and I tried to make this, like, very usable. You can skip from chapter to chapter or just start with the very first short chapter, and I really tried to make it not too much to read because, you know, when you're depressed, you know, I just wrote another book, actually. It's on anxiety and depression.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, what I've learned is a lot of times with anxiety, people will read lots of things. But I find with people with depression that, you know, it's, you know, they don't feel like doing anything, let alone read a big book. So I really tried to make it as easy as possible.
What's your website, Dr. Buongiorno?
Thanks for asking. Well, my clinic website is innersourcehealth.com. That's INNERSOURCE health.com.
Uh-huh.
And then my personal website is drpeterbongiorno.com. So DR, Peter, and then Buongiorno. Since most people don't know how to spell that, it's a BONGIORNO.com. So drpeterbongiorno.com.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Hey, it was great to have you on. And we'll have you on again when the anxiety book comes out. Let us know.
Okay, thank you. Thank you
okay.
so much. And thank
sure.
you for all the work you're doing. You know, I see I have a lot of students who come through my office from the University of Bridgeport. In fact, we have two Bridgeport grads who are with us now in our practice. And you're just doing amazing work, and you're changing the world with the work you're doing and sending such good doctors out there.
Oh, thanks.
So thank you.
Makes me feel good. Okay. And so that's it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Stay healthy, folks. Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.